This is voodoo medicine when we start talking about drugs.
The downside of administering one of these drugs is death.
The use of amio or lidocaine does not improve survival to hospital discharge with meaningful neurologic survival.
I'm not throwing out amio or lido yet. What we do downstairs matters.
Even the injured brain is smarter than we are.
Welcome, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. I'm Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, here not with one, not with two, but all three of my colleagues here on CCPM, Dr. Peter W. from LSU, Dr. Rob Rodriguez from UCSF, and Dr. John Greenwood from the University of Pennsylvania. Yes, we are getting 2017 started with a bang, and no better way to really begin the year than all of us discussing what we think are some top 10 articles of the year from 2016 in terms of the emergency medicine, critical care, and resuscitation literature. Gentlemen, Happy New Year to each of you. I hope that the holidays went well. How is your January going thus far?
It's rocking here. Unseasonably mild in New Orleans, but that's a little dangerous as we crawl into the carnival season.
Rob, how about you out west?
Very, very wet. We've been drenched for the past month, really, and hopefully California's finally coming out of the prolonged drought.
Well, John, I know you're not too far north of me, so our weathers are the same, but how are things up at Penn?
Going great at Penn. The Critical Care Resuscitation Unit, also known as the Rescue, is coming along quite well. We're excited to have a new ED-based ICU up and running, and all in all, family's good, friends are good, can't complain.
All right. Well, my thanks to all three of you for joining me for this exciting podcast. As we've done every year in January, we like to review some key, potentially practice-changing articles from the prior year's literature pertaining to the resuscitation and care of critically ill patients in the ED. Now, even though we say top 10, these aren't in any order of importance. We're just going to go by categories. And let's get things started off with some neurocritical care, two articles that everyone needs to be aware of and think about when you're resuscitating that critical care patient who has an intracerebral hemorrhage. And our first article on this podcast is by Qureshi, New England Journal of Medicine. This was the ATTACK 2 trial titled Intensive Blood Pressure Lowering in Patients with Acute Cerebral Hemorrhage. We've all seen these patients. They've come in, they have an intracerebral hemorrhage, and they have markedly elevated blood pressure. Well, the objective of the ATTACK 2 trial, or ATTACK 2, however you want to say it, was to determine the relative efficacy of intensive versus standard blood pressure lowering initiated within 4.5 hours after symptom onset and continued for the next 24 hours in patients with a spontaneous supratentorial ICH. This was a randomized, multi-center, two-group open-label trial of adult patients who came into the ED, in essence, had an ICH, had a GCS of 5 or more, and had at least one blood pressure reading of a systolic blood pressure greater than 180 millimeters of mercury. In essence, patients were randomized to two groups, a standard group where they kept blood pressure between 140 to 170, and an intensive treatment group where they lowered systolic pressure between 110 to 139 millimeters of mercury. And they primarily used nicardipine. So if everyone recalls the issues with the INTERACT 2 trial, lots of different blood pressure medicines used. The primary one isn't available in the United States. And this particular trial, the one we're discussing now, really gets more to standard practice using IV nicardipine. What was their primary outcome? The proportion of patients who had moderately severe or severe disability or who had died at 3 months, and they assessed that disability with a modified Rankin score. Now, what were the results? Overall, 1,000 patients randomized across 110 sites, and the take-home message, death or disability was no different between those in the standard group versus those in the invasive intensive blood pressure lowering group. No significant difference between groups in the ordinal distribution of their modified Rankin score, and really no difference in serious adverse events. So, gentlemen, as we get this podcast started, the first one's a big one from 2016, dealing with blood pressure control in patients with acute ICH. John, let me turn to you. How do you incorporate this particular study into your current practice?
Well, overall, I agree. I think the study was a good study. It was fairly well done with maybe some marginal differences between the treatment groups. But overall, I agree. I mean, I think that the evidence here is fairly clear that we don't need to push the blood pressure too low to that strict group of 110 to 140 and maybe just keep it close to the 160 to less than 180. This kind of smells a little bit to me similar to the tight glycemic control study. As we know, One of the things that we want to try to avoid as much as possible is hypotension in our patients with traumatic brain injury or intracranial hemorrhage. So once again, kind of maybe not too low, but somewhere in the middle is probably best.
Great. Peter, what about your thoughts?
You know, I would echo John's sentiments. I would just offer this, that even the injured brain is smarter than we are. So it knows that it needs a higher perfusion pressure. And so we get pretty foolish when we start wanting to super control it or make it very tight. So I would agree, you know, unless the systolics are far in excess of 180, I'm happy with keeping it there.
And Rob, are you titrating blood pressure, systolic pressures to 160 to 180, or do you have additional target range?
No, I like the analogy that John made between this and the glucose study, intensive insulin therapy for hyperglycemia type studies. We had a couple of studies a few years back that showed that, yeah, that we probably should at least lower it below 180 systolic, and that the temptation becomes that if that proved to be effective, maybe even heavier, more intensive type interventions would make it even better. And so that's really where this kind of arose. And it's just a good study. I thought it was really well done. And I'm letting it flow between 140 to 180, more or less.
All right, outstanding. Well, let's stick with the neurocritical care theme and talk about probably the other popular trial from 2016 that was frequently and highly discussed throughout many realms. And that is the idea of transfusing platelets to patients with an ICH who come in and they're taking an antiplatelet medication. This was the PATCH trial. This was published in Lancet in 2016, entitled Platelet Transfusion Versus Standard Care After Acute Stroke Due to Spontaneous Cerebral Hemorrhage Associated with Antiplatelet Therapy, a randomized open label phase 3 trial. And in essence, this was, as they state, multi-center randomized parallel group trial carried out in 36 hospitals in the Netherlands, 13 in the UK, and 11 hospitals in France, including adult patients with a non-traumatic supratentorial ICH, GCS ranging 8 to 17, and they were taking an antiplatelet medication for at least 7 days prior to their presentation with an acute ICH. And those antiplatelet medications primarily included aspirin, clopidogrel, or dipyridamole. And importantly, that platelet transfusion had to be started within 6 hours of symptom onset or within 90 minutes of brain imaging. Well, patients were randomized 1-to-1 either standard care or standard care plus a platelet transfusion. And their primary outcome was, what was the difference in functional outcome at 3 months after randomization, once again scored with the modified Rankin score? What were the results? 190 patients enrolled at 41 sites. And the take-home message, the primary outcome, surprisingly, there was a shift towards death or dependence at 3 months for patients in the platelet group compared to those in the standard treatment that got no platelet transfusions. Secondary outcomes weren't significantly different, but when you look at the serious adverse events, even though it may not have been statistically significant, much higher in the platelet group versus those in the standard group that were not transfused. So in terms of a take-home message, we need to rethink empirically giving platelets to patients coming in with an ICH who are taking one of these antiplatelet medications, primarily aspirin or clopidogrel. Peter, let me jump to you first on the PATCH trial. Thoughts, and how are you incorporating this one into your current practice?
Yeah, this is a huge game changer for me in my practice because, you know, if I thought you were coming in on Plavix and having an intracranial hemorrhage, I was reaching for platelets pretty quickly. And this is really put an end to that. So good to utilize the resources when we need it. This is one of the indications where we have studied it and it's clear that we don't need it. It actually can do some harm to the patients. So this is a big changer for me in my practice.
Great. Rob, what about you?
You know, I never really used to transfuse platelets in this scenario. So really it hasn't changed my practice much. Although it's very, very interesting that the platelet group wound up with essentially worse outcomes. And it kind of goes to show that there's a lot going on in the microcirculation, and perhaps this transfusion of platelets can be triggering further microocclusions and causing more harm. So I'll be interested to see. I think the next takeoff from this is going to be consideration of withholding or trials of platelets in other life-threatening hemorrhage situations. And I think there probably will be other looks at this.
John, your thoughts?
So I think it's interesting. I'm actually going to take the other side to this argument here. And I have a couple concerns about this study. It was fairly small, and I'm not sure that it was really powered to find that much of a difference. Now it did, but what it means, I can't quite tell. I mean, it was only about what, like, was it 180 patients or so? So it's a relatively small study. But, you know, the use of aspirin and Plavix themselves, I kind of know this a little bit just with working with VAD patients. And I remember as a fellow at Maryland, we did a lot of platelet function testing and uses of TEG. We know that not everyone's an aspirin or Plavix responder. There's a little bit of a variable response. So whether or not those medications are therapeutic, and if you're given platelets themselves to reverse that, I think the point I'm trying to make is that the patient's response can be variable. So I don't quite know that this study does it for me in terms of making me stop transfused platelets for someone on antiplatelet. So I think there still needs to be a little bit more study on this. I don't think I'm there yet to change my practice. It's an interesting study, but definitely not something that completely changed my practice.
Well, great comments, guys. Certainly two potential game changers in terms of the neurocritical care literature that we as acute care providers, emergency physicians, intensivists, hospitalists, acute care physicians should know as we head into 2017. Well, let's switch gears to a different topic. Let's talk about cardiac arrest, probably the quintessential shock and critical illness. Now, certainly we've got patients come in and they have a shockable rhythm. We attempt early defibrillation, and then when they do not respond or convert to spontaneous circulation, we start thinking they're shock refractory in terms of VFib or pulses VT, and often we're reaching for an antiarrhythmic. So that brings us to the next article by Kudenchuk in New England Journal of Medicine entitled Amiodarone, Lidocaine, or Placebo in Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest. In essence, these investigators wanted to compare the effects of amiodarone, lidocaine, and placebo on survival to hospital discharge after out-of-hospital cardiac arrest due to shock refractory VF or pulseless VT. This was a randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled pre-hospital trial carried out in 55 EMS agencies at 10 North American sites that were included in the Resuscitation's Outcome Consortium. And in essence, they included adults with non-traumatic out-of-hospital cardiac arrest who had shock refractory VF or pulseless VT, and that's in essence, they failed to respond to one or more shocks and have ROSC following early defibrillation. Well, they were randomized to either amio, lidocaine, or placebo, and they looked at a primary outcome of survival to hospital discharge with a secondary outcome of survival with favorable neurologic status at hospital discharge. Over 3,000 patients included in this study. Survival to hospital discharge, no change. No statistical difference between amiodarone, lidocaine, and placebo. In terms of favorable neurologic status, no change between those who got amiodarone, lidocaine, or placebo, with the caveat being those that had bystander witnessed arrest did have a few percentage points higher in terms of survival to hospital discharge who got an antiarrhythmic. So amio and lidocaine were about 28% versus 23% in the placebo group. So some have held on to that, saying there's still utility in antiarrhythmics for a select cohort, but I think a lot of people have looked at this particular large study saying that, you know what, the use of amio or lidocaine does not improve survival to hospital discharge with meaningful neurologic survival in our patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrests who don't respond to those initial defibrillation attempts. So Rob, I'm turning to you first. What are your thoughts on this article?
You know, I have some concerns about this article. I think that it's obviously a well-designed study. These types of studies are obviously very difficult to accomplish. There are a lot of resources to get them done. I'm still not going to throw away amio and lido. I think that the subgroup analyses were compelling enough. And even if you look at the survival to hospital discharge without the subgroup analysis, there's a little bit of lean towards amio and lido in terms of maybe 3% difference that didn't meet statistical significance. So getting back to the design of the study, it's only going to be powered to show a certain level of difference. Let's say amio or lido make a difference of about 1% to 2% in terms of outcome. I think that's significant, and that's obviously better than death. So I'm not throwing away amio and lido. I'm not saying that they are the savior in cardiac arrest, but really nothing is besides CPR and rapid defibrillation.
John, what are your thoughts on this article?
I agree with Robin. Pretty sure I can keep this short. I'm not throwing out Amio or Lido yet. I think that there still is a role, especially with Pulse's VT or VF. It's important that it's used appropriately in terms of the dosing, that it's not just started as an infusion, but you do get some loading doses in there. But I think the take-home point is fair, that it doesn't improve survival. But I don't think that this study will ultimately change my practice for patients that are still presenting in VF or VT quite yet.
All right, Peter, you have the final word. Are you going to keep Amio with a faint pulse, or are we tossing it to the wayside?
It's not kicked to the curb yet, and I hate to say that, but the good part is, for our listeners, is that the evidence continues to mount about the futility of drugs and cardiac arrest. And as Rob pointed to earlier, great CPR and early defibrillation wins out. Those are our game changers. The drugs, not so much. But that's all drugs, whether it be vasopressors, whether it be any other drug you want to do. I mean, you can sprinkle chicken blood around them and have about the same outcome as you are going to have with lidocaine and amiodarone. But having said that, I would still apply it. But I do so with the whole cocktail to include my epinephrine and for these patients to include magnesium therapy. Just, again, not strong evidence in support of that, because I don't think the evidence is strong anywhere with drug therapy and improving outcomes for cardiac arrest.
Is that a New Orleans Creole medicine thing? What is it, chicken blood?
This is voodoo medicine when we start talking about drugs and ACLS protocols and what we've done historically. I don't think we're far off of that.
You guys are just throwing the analogies out left and right today.
One last comment on that is, whenever you're thinking about drugs and trials like this, you obviously got to look at the cost and the downside. The downside of administering one of these drugs is death, right? And they're already going to die. There's really no downside from a clinical standpoint. The cost, Amio and Lido is certainly cheap. Amio is, I think, fairly cheap. So I would still consider any sort of survival benefit of 1% to 2% as being a positive outcome anyway. Just wanted to throw that out there as well.
And I hear you on that one. I'm just not even sure that that 1% to 2% is powered that well, is my point on that. But I'm with you.
It may not be real. It may not exist. Right. But this study did not test for that.
Agreed.
All right. Well, let's stick with the cardiac arrest, and let's talk about a pre-hospital therapy, and that's the potential for pre-hospital cooling or therapeutic hypothermia. We have a number of EMS and pre-hospital providers listening to the podcast, and the RINCE trial was published in Circulation in 2016. This was by Bernard and colleagues, titled Induction of Therapeutic Hypothermia During Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest Using a Rapid Infusion of Cold Saline. So, in essence, we know that targeted temperature management is beneficial for select patients with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest. Is it even more beneficial if we get it started during the arrest or intra-arrest in the pre-hospital setting? Well, this, in essence, was a multi-center randomized controlled trial in EMS agencies in three cities in Australia. And in essence, what they wanted to do was compare the induction of therapeutic hypothermia during CPR in out-of-hospital cardiac arrest patients using an infusion of cold saline and compare that with standard care. These were adult patients, cardiac arrest upon EMS arrival, who were still in cardiac arrest after IV access, ventilation with O2, a dose of epi, and defibrillation. Well, they were randomized either to standard care or an infusion of 30 mLs per kilogram of cold saline up until about 2 liters. Their primary outcome, survival to hospital discharge. Also, the secondary outcome with a proportion of patients in a shockable rhythm and a non-shockable rhythm who ultimately got ROSC. Almost 1,200 patients in the RINCE trial, and in essence, the outcomes, there was no difference in survival at hospital discharge between those that got intra-arrest cooling versus standard care. However, there was a significant decrease in the number of patients who had an initial shockable rhythm, who got hypothermia or the cold saline, and then had ROSC, 41%. Versus 51% in the standard care arm. So many have looked at the RINCE trial from 2016 as additional evidence that we probably should not be doing intra-arrest cooling in the pre-hospital setting, as it results in a reduction of ROSC for patients who have a shockable rhythm. John, what do you think about the RINCE trial?
Well, RINCE, I mean, was done by Stephen Bernard, one of the real godfathers of therapeutic hypothermia. And I think some of this also had played into his interest cooling, along with his ECPR studies down there in Melbourne, Sydney, and Australia. Overall, I think, granted, this study was stopped early, so he didn't get a chance to get to full power in terms of enrollment, but enrolled a good number of patients. I think that the takeaway point for me is, get ROSC, get a neurostatus, and determine whether or not therapeutic hypothermia is appropriate for your patient. I think that's a rational approach to this, but that intra-rest cooling may not provide any additional benefit to a good neurologic outcome.
Peter?
Yeah, I want my pre-hospital providers, who I'm showing love to be focusing on getting ROSC, not cooling. Right? I think that's where their attention needs to lie. And they have only so many hands and so many priorities to deal with. I don't want them to be thinking about cooling before getting ROSC. I want them to focus on the ROSC.
Mm-hmm. Rob, how about you?
That's an absolute critical point that Peter just made. Not just trying to kiss your butt after the last sequence. but I really do think that our EMS providers need to focus on CPR and defibrillation. And this would distract them from that, and somewhat glad that it was shown not to improve survival.
All right, well, let's round out cardiac arrest with one fairly obvious, but I think an important study that was recently published in resuscitation dealing with point-of-care ultrasound in cardiac arrest. This was by Gaspari and colleagues, entitled Emergency Department Point-of-Care Ultrasound in Out-of-Hospital and in ED Cardiac Arrest. In essence, we all know that point-of-care ultrasound is extremely useful in a lot of critical conditions that we see in the emergency department, in the ICU, crashing patients on the floor. But there's very little literature that's formally studied this in the cardiac arrest setting. So these investigators set out to determine the association between ultrasound, visible cardiac activity, and survival in patients who came in with PEA or asystole, so a select group of patients with cardiac arrest. This was a multi-center, prospective, protocol-driven observational study where they included everybody who came in with non-traumatic cardiac arrest who was in PEA or asystole in 20 sites across the U.S. and Canada, and those who had ultrasound imaging during the course of their resuscitation. And in essence, the ultrasound probe went on the chest at the beginning of ACLS interventions. They used either a subxiphoid or a peristernal long axis, and they considered any movement of the myocardium as cardiac activity within the chambers, or valve movement as significant cardiac activity. Overall, they wanted to know what was the percentage of patients that survived to hospital admission, with secondary outcomes of survival to hospital discharge, and the percentage of patients with ROSC. Almost 1,000 patients enrolled in this particular study, and of the 33% that had cardiac activity on the initial ultrasound, over 50% got ROSC, almost 29% survived to hospital admission, and just about 4% survived to hospital discharge. In contrast with those who had no cardiac activity, as you would guess, ROSC was really low at 14%, survival to hospital admission 7%, and survival to hospital discharge was less than 1% in this group. Now, ultrasound also picked up 34 cases of pericardial effusion, along with 15 patients were thought to have PE by findings on that initial ultrasound. So, take-home messages from this particular study: we know point-of-care ultrasound is good, but in terms of patients who are coming in cardiac arrest in that cohort with PEA or asystole, the two factors strongly associated with survival to hospital admission and discharge were PEA along with cardiac activity, and the lack of cardiac activity along with asystole were strongly associated with a lack of survival. Now, certainly this isn't the only data point you should probably use to terminate resuscitative efforts, but Peter, this certainly gives a little bit more data to give us, inform us, how long perhaps we should be going with resuscitative efforts.
Right. And again, I think that for our listeners, I think that this is critically important. This is no different than a stethoscope 20 years ago. This ultrasound needs to be in our hands when we're looking at PEA and helping us guide our therapies, whether it's to evacuate the pericardial space or give thrombolytics or consider chest tube placement for tension pneumothorax. It helps us focus our resuscitative efforts and improve outcomes for patients long time.
Rob, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree completely. I like the outcome that they identified: rapidly reversible causes, some of which received things like TPA or pericardiocentesis. Again, I like your analogy with the stethoscope. We should be using it very often in this setting, both to determine when to stop and to determine reversible causes. So yeah, I think this is a great study pushing us to incorporate ultrasound even further.
John, I know that you're a big fan of ultrasound.
No, absolutely. I'm one of the younger guys here, and I use it early and often. As everyone else has suggested, I think it's very valuable. And so it's nice to see something in the literature that supports my biases. But again, I think that this is something we all know and felt. But again, it's good to see it finally come into manuscript.
All right, well, we're continuing on here in our top 10. We'll go relatively quickly through the remaining five articles. Let's touch on one article dealing with rapid sequence intubation. We know that intubations in the ED or in the ICU can be difficult. They can be higher risk, much higher incidence of complications when compared to controlled intubations in the operating room. And we know that there are some studies out there that say, well, pre-oxygenation, patient positioning is critical. Putting the backup head elevated position versus a supine has been shown to be beneficial. Well, what about actually during intubation? This was a study published in Anesthesia and Analgesia titled Head Elevated Patient Positioning Decreases Complications of Emergent Tracheal Intubation in the Ward and Intensive Care Unit. In essence, they wanted to determine if this backup head elevated position was associated with a decrease in complications related to endotracheal intubation outside of the operating room. Now, in contrast to our other studies, this was a retrospective cohort at two large academic centers out west. And in essence, they included patients intubated outside of the OR or PACU, where attempts were made with direct laryngoscopy. And they wanted to know, primary outcome, what was the occurrence of a complication or any intubated related complication? And they included difficult intubation, hypoxemia, esophageal intubations, or pulmonary aspiration. Overall, 530 patients included in the study, intubated related complications in the supine position occurred almost 23% of the time versus when patients were intubated in the back up head elevated position, just 9.3%. So a definite sizable difference in terms of the complications by simply elevating the head of the bed. So Rob, in terms of intubations, incorporating this into your practice, are you going to be placing patients with a head elevated or back up head elevated position?
You know, I did this before this study. I think that this is a great little study outside of the kind of general ER emergency medicine literature that we normally review. I think that this really should be standard practice at this point. And I've done this for some time, and I think that it's one of those basic, no frills kind of additions to care to improve outcomes.
Peter, what about you?
So I like the idea, as Rob says, to extrapolate this to the ED. Study not done on the ED, done in the ICU, done on the floors, but what are our messages? Our patients are far more likely to have food in their stomachs and drinks in their stomachs and far more likely to aspirate. I think that what also makes this a big difference is as the populations across the world, but particularly our country, continue to grow in size, and talking about the issue of morbid obesity creeping into everybody's practice and patient populations, this plays a bigger role. So body positioning so that we have visual axis alignment is a big deal, but it's also letting gravity be your friend, right? So that back up position makes it less likely to have food wash up into the back of the throat. It also makes it more likely that the air that you push down is going to get into the lungs and have less resistance there. So again, those are good things. And so I think these are practice changers.
And John, your thoughts on this article?
I think it's a great article. And I think it does a couple of things. By forcing someone to potentially use a positioning that's a little bit different, they get forced to kind of pay attention to some of the more minor details that might actually make a huge impact, which might make them major details in terms of patient positioning, making sure that everything's aligned appropriately that might otherwise go unnoticed or not thought about the patient's supine. Yeah, it's quite a clever composite measure being esophageal intubation, aspiration, hypoxemia. And if you break out the different components of that composite measure, the biggest difference looks to be hypoxemia. So I just pulled up the article here and reviewed it one more time, and it looks like 54 out of the 330 so patients got hypoxic in the supine group compared to only 12 in the head of bed elevated group. So that seemed to be the biggest impact of them all, as Peter alluded to, the fact that let gravity help you out and prevent that stomach from compressing your lungs and losing your vital capacity does make a huge difference. So definitely something to incorporate in my practice and hopefully others.
Outstanding, outstanding comments. Well, let's continue with another article from Anesthesia and Analgesia, and let's switch topics from RSI to actually mechanical ventilation. Now, we've talked about this analgo-sedation approach before on the podcast, whereby we initiate the analgesic first in intubated patients, followed then by the sedative, and there's a whole lot of benefits that come from that. Well, this was an article published in, once again, Anesthesia and Analgesia in 2016, titled The Impact of an Analgesia-Based Sedation Protocol on Mechanically Ventilated Patients in the Medical Intensive Care Unit. And in essence, what they wanted to do was evaluate the impact of an analgo-sedation protocol on the duration of mechanical ventilation, ICU length of stay, sedation levels, and also medication costs. This was a retrospective study out of a MICU in Texas, whereby what they did is look at their pre-implementation phase, where they typically gave propofol for sedation first, and then afterwards they would kind of sprinkle in some narcotics if the patient needed it, or perhaps even a second sedative such as midazolam. Then they went through an educational campaign. They flipped that to an analgo sedation protocol, and their post-implementation group really focused on treating pain before sedative or antipsychotic use. So they would typically use the opioid first, namely fentanyl, then they would use either propofol or dexmedetomidine afterwards. And once again, their primary outcome being the duration of mechanical ventilation. Well, what were the results? Almost 240 patients, and in that post-implementation group, so the ones that got the analgesic first, there were lighter levels of sedation, decreased duration of mechanical ventilation, decreased ICU length of stay on the order of 51 hours, and overall better pain management. So some nice evidence to reinforce what we've been talking about. Start off with the analgesic first, then go to your sedatives, and it can really help you get better pain management, titrate to those recommended lighter levels of sedation, and ultimately get those patients off the vent and out of the ICU much quicker. Peter? Do you like this approach?
Yeah, I'm a big believer in how we've kind of been cruel to patients with oligol analgesia in the ICU. And so I really do push fentanyl as my first line agent for sedation for my patients who are intubated in the ICU. And I think this makes a big, big difference. It's nice to have the evidence champion this as well, particularly with so much pushback from the federal government with opioid use and the concerns around that. And I get that. We have to balance this over time, but particularly for the first 2 days, I would push for fentanyl use as my main line sedative.
John, what about you?
I do follow the analgo-sedation kind of strategy. It's interesting that this study kind of took place looking back at 2009 versus 2012 or so. That 2012 time, I think, was about the time the whole SECM, ABCDE bundle sort of started getting pushed. So earlier and quicker extubation is definitely something that's been on the front of our brains as intensivists now for the past few years. So that might have impacted the outcomes here. But overall, I think the message is a good one. Really focus on pain control first to try to minimize the amount of sedatives required for critically ill patients.
Rob, do you agree?
I'm a little less enthusiastic. You know, I definitely agree that we don't treat pain as aggressively as we should. However, this study more impacts my ICU management of patients. In the ED, I'm going to start both of the agents at the same time. I'm going to give them a slug of fentanyl and typically propofol or some other agent at the same time. I'm not typically doing it stepwise, at least for the patients that I intubate in the ED.
All right. Well, let's continue. We are almost done. Let's talk about the oxygen ICU trial that was published recently in JAMA, specifically another topic on mechanical ventilation. We've talked also at length in various episodes before about the problems with hyperoxemia or elevated levels of oxygen in terms of keeping patients way high on the vent, or hyperoxia problems, creating all sorts of free radicals, tissue dysfunction. Well, this was a study that was published in JAMA entitled The Effect of Conservative versus Conventional Oxygen Therapy on Mortality Among Patients in an Intensive Care Unit, the Oxygen ICU Randomized Clinical Trial. In essence, they wanted to determine whether the application of a conservative protocol for oxygen supplementation to simply maintain PaO2 within physiologic limits would improve outcomes in critically critically ill ICU patients. Now, admittedly, this was a single center randomized clinical trial that included adult patients who were admitted to the ICU who had an expected length of stay of at least 3 or more days, and they were randomized either to conventional or conservative oxygen therapy. The conventional oxygen therapy group was simply given oxygen, and the PaO2 values were allowed to go up to about 150 millimeters of mercury with a pulse oximetry reading anywhere between 97 to 100%, compared with the conservative group. So oxygen was administered at much lower FiO2 values, and they were titrating to a PaO2 between 70 and 100, and really only targeting pulse oximetry readings between 94 and 98%, and they ultimately wanted to know their primary outcome was ICU mortality. So the results, 480 patients included in this trial, and the mortality for the conventional group, so got oxygen to maintain SATs 97 to 100%, was 20.2% compared with the conservative group, so much lower levels of FiO2 to maintain SATs between 94 to 98%. That mortality was just 11.6%, so a significant decrease in mortality by titrating down the FiO2. Now, as Rob just alluded to with respect to the prior study, maybe a little bit more applicable in the ICU, but John, let me go to you first. Wouldn't this be very reasonable in patients who are boarding in the ED on mechanical ventilation to really pay attention to how much FiO2 we're giving them?
Absolutely. Of all the 10, this is probably, in my opinion, the most important one we're talking about today, partly because of the effects of hyperoxia and how it can really injure our patients, both short-term and more specifically long-term. This is a really well-done trial. It was randomized, and it's really unfortunate it was stopped short, but I don't think it detracts from the underlying findings. There was a good differentiation between the median values of both groups, so that's good there. And it showed us a pretty profound difference. So we need to get the oxygen down. And biologically, this makes sense as well. We know hyperoxia does a number of things. It increases free oxygen radicals. It decreases microvascular perfusion. It makes the blood flow sluggish in those microvessels, which can really cause some trouble down the road. So this is something I think we have to pay attention to early and set the stage for once they get upstairs, because what we do downstairs matters. And this is one of those easy interventions, low-cost interventions that can make a really significant impact on our patients.
Definitely agree. Rob, what about you? Are you dialing down the FiO2 while they're in the ED?
You know, this to me, I completely agree with John that this is the study of the year for me by far. This really has changed my practice, and I really do think we need to institute this within the ED itself. We have a lot of other data, a lot of other studies that show post-arrest hyperoxia is associated with worse outcomes. So we really just need to make it a point to dial our O2 down as soon as possible. And I'm doing this very aggressively in the ED. As soon as I have somebody intubated, I titrate down their FiO2. And I think this is just a great study.
Peter, I heard you talk about this at critical points. So I know that you're a fan of dialing this down, right?
Yeah, but I don't have great hopes for our practice. And, you know, we had far better data with ARDSnet. And here we are 10 years later, and we still have about 70% penetrance into clinical practice. So we are going to really need some more studies that echo this. And again, these people just made this shit up, this 94 to 98%. It's arbitrary. So there may even be a lower number that's better. I mean, you look at ARDSnet and people are looking at 86% SATs, 87, 88% SATs with improved survival outcomes with saturations that low. So I think we still have a ways to go before we hit the right number, if you will, or the right range. And I think we have a ways to go before we really convince all the practicing clinicians out there who touch critical care patients to use something other than 100.
Well said. Well, we've only got two more to go. We're going to wrap this up pretty quickly. Let's switch gears and talk about fluid responsiveness. We did this recently here on the podcast, and we talked about this article, so we're not going to do a deep dive on it. Recall that in terms of predicting fluid responsiveness, only about 50% of critically ill patients are going to respond to that fluid bolus. And for that 50% that are on the flat portion of their Starling curve, we may be harming them by giving additional IV fluids. So how do we know when enough is enough? Well, this particular study published in Critical Care Medicine early to midway through 2016 by Chirpanath, titled Predicting Fluid Responsiveness by Passive Leg Raising, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis of 23 Clinical Trials. In essence, these authors investigated the available literature on passive leg raise and fluid responsiveness to give us an overall predictive value of passive leg raise across various settings. In essence, 23 articles, over 1,000 patients, and the take-home message was that passive leg raise, in fact, is a reliable tool to predict fluid responsiveness across various clinical settings, both the intubated or mechanically ventilated, along with the spontaneously breathing patient. John, are you using passive leg raise in your clinical practice?
You know, I am. For the most part, I think this is really helpful, especially for our non-intubated patients, just because of all the confounders that come into place with all the fluid responsiveness studies. But this one seems to be fairly consistent in literature as a really good tool, so I do try to incorporate it as much as I can.
Rob, what about you?
I do. This is, again, a very simple study, very easy to do, and has been shown to be the most reliable tool, so I do it.
Peter, are you recommending passive leg raise?
You know, I do. And just to echo what Rob says, it's not just a reliable tool, it's the most reliable tool that we have.
Outstanding. Well, we've reached the end of our top articles for 2016, and we're going to end with probably the article that everybody's aware of from 2016, so we don't need to do a deep dive, and that is Sepsis 3.0. Singer and colleague in JAMA, early 2016 in JAMA, published the third international consensus definitions for sepsis and septic shock. As you know, this was a joint venture between the European Society of Intensive Care Medicine and the Society of Critical Care Medicine, where they got together a 19-member task force that included critical care, ID, surgical, and pulmonary specialists to task them with updating the definitions of sepsis and septic shock, along with identifying clinical criteria that would pick out elements of infection, host response, and organ dysfunction. And the take-home messages from this paper were that sepsis they defined as, quote, life-threatening organ dysfunction caused by a dysregulated host response to infection. And they, in terms of putting us all on the same page, recommended identifying organ dysfunction through the use of the SOFA score. They came up with, retrospectively derived, the QSOFA score, three components for patients outside of the ICU that included altered mental status with a GCS less than 13, tachypnea, respiratory rate greater than or equal to 22, and a systolic blood pressure less than or equal to 100 millimeters of mercury. They defined septic shock as a subset of sepsis in which profound circulatory, cellular, and metabolic abnormalities are associated with a greater risk of mortality. And the clinical criteria for septic shock, patients who had adequate fluid resuscitation, needed vasopressors to maintain a MAP greater than 65 millimeters of mercury, and a lactate greater than or equal to 2 millimoles per liter. And finally, the terms severe sepsis, gone, and the use of SIRS, also gone from sepsis 3.0. So gentlemen, as we wrap up our discussion here, outstanding discussion. John, let me get your thoughts on sepsis 3.0.
Well, I think the intent is good of sepsis 3.0. Getting back to the organ dysfunction as being the primary differentiator between just an infection and sepsis is important. I think what the authors are really trying to do is putting out there a way for us to start phenotyping sepsis a little bit better, as opposed to just a bad infection and the syndrome that we have. As far as QSOFA goes, I think the criteria in general, they identify sick patients. And anyone who comes into the ED with a new altered mental status, tachypneic, or a low blood pressure, they're likely going to have a higher mortality than someone who doesn't have end organ dysfunction as a result of their primary process. So I don't know what QSOFA really adds to the screening tools that we already have. Probably don't make a whole bunch of difference, but I think they're important for the clinician to keep an eye out for. And at the end of the day, I think the biggest change was really noting that a lactate greater than 2 is abnormal. So that's something to keep in mind.
Rob, your thoughts?
Yeah, so this was a very interesting study, right down kind of my area of research interest. And in fact, John didn't mention it, but we're taking a look at the QSOFA criteria. It's notable that this study was done, or the QSOFA criteria were developed in not just an ED population. It was patients from outside of the ED, including patients on the wards and so forth. So they have yet to be validated as a screening tool in the ED, and it's unclear whether QSOFA can replace or augment current sepsis screening tools.
And Peter, the final word.
Yeah, the utility for me, for my practice, for QSOFA, is in arguing who needs critical care resources, whether they be a rapid response or whether they be in the emergency department. The other caveat that I get from QSOFA that I find helpful for arguing for resources is educating everybody that a respiratory rate greater than 22 is of concern. And so if that brings mindfulness to providers about patients and how sick patients can be with that tachypnea measure, that's helpful.
Well, that will do it for our top 10 articles from 2016. Our thanks for listening. We know that we went a little bit long in terms of this, but I think that we covered some outstanding pearls, the big articles, most frequently discussed articles from 2016, and hope that provided you with a lot of pearls to take back to the bedside with your next few shifts. We're going to end things there and look forward to talking to you next podcast here on CCP EM.